same.
All right. The Chief Judge and the Judges of the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals draw near. For the court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated. Court is called to order. Court calls the case of United States versus Captain Robert L. Juanita III, ACM 38905. Today we consider two issues during oral arguments. They are, first, whether the military judge erred when after dismissing a charge alleging abusive sexual conduct for failure to state an offense, she concluded trial could proceed on the purported lesser included offense of assault consummated by a battery. And second, whether the evidence is factually and legally sufficient to prove the assault consummated by a battery. Appellate's counsel, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
5 minutes, Your Honor.
Very well, you may proceed.
Thank you, Chief Judge Drew, and may it please the court. I'm Brian Miser, and along with Colonel Jeff Palomino, we represent the appellant, Captain Bobby Honey. Excuse me. The test before the court this morning is fairly straightforward. Today, as judges, you need only adhere to the prior decisions of your predecessors on this court and your sister service courts of criminal appeals in holding that consent is not an element of abusive sexual contact by bodily harm, and that therefore assault consummated by a battery cannot be a lesser included offense of that crime.
Well, Mr. Miser, I don't mean to interrupt so early on in your argument, but one thing that I did note in your brief, and you made fairly heavy use of it, is you cite an unpublished opinion of this court. And you indicate now that we're obligated to adhere to an unpublished opinion of another panel of this court. What implication, if any, do you take on the fact that that particular opinion was, in fact, unpublished?
Judge, is not binding precedent. It's persuasive authority. And I mean to leave no other indication with this court. But Judge Weedy's opinion in Barlow that we're referring to is well thought out. It references the legislative history of the 2007 version of Article 120, and it's consistent with what the other service courts of criminal appeals have done, some in unpublished decisions like Protho before the Army Corps, and earlier this year in Gwin, the Navy Marine Corps Court actually published a decision on the 2012 statute dealing with abusive sexual contact. Now, that also is persuasive authority before this court, but there doesn't appear to be any dissent between the courts of criminal appeals, whether they be published or unpublished decisions, Chief Judge Drew. The only thing I mean to say is that the heavy lifting, if you will, has been done by your predecessors on this court and the service courts of criminal appeals, including that consent is not an element of abusive sexual contact, and I would urge the court to adhere to those decisions today. You're certainly not bound, Judge.
Counsel, let me dig down a little bit deeper. You talk generally about the proposition that consent is not an element for abusive sexual contact, but are there different manners in which someone could commit the offense of abusive sexual contact? In other words, by fear, as in Barlow and Riggins, or in this case, by bodily harm?
Yes, Judge.
Right. Should the theory as to why it's abusive sexual contact, is that relevant in determining whether or not consent is an element?
It can be, Judge. I think that there are some versions of abusive sexual contact where consent is not an element, and bodily harm is one of those. And under the 2007 statute, your job is made very simple by the fact that you need to just look at the language of the statute. Article 120, subsection R, says consent is only an element of wrongful sexual contact. And then it goes on to say, quote, consent and mistake of fact as to consent are not an issue or an affirmative defense in a prosecution under any other subsection, except they are an affirmative defense for sexual abuse of sexual contact. Not an element. And as you know, one of the primary canons of statutory construction is that interpretation begins and ends with the plain language of the statute. When Congress says that it's not an element, that's the end of the discussion.
Well, counsel, then how do you explain Prather? And in Prather, they looked at consent as it relates to substantial incapacitation. And CAF, in that case, said that despite all the language you're just referring to about consent is not an issue and everything else, CAF said because of how substantial incapacitation is defined, consent is, in fact, an issue or a subset of substantial incapacitation. Or, to put it another way, if the government proves substantial incapacitation, they have therefore proved lack of consent. So they did read in effectively consent, and they found that the government in such a case would have to prove lack of consent beyond a reasonable doubt.
And Judge, I think that the footnote 7 in Wiggins, when they say that there are potentially categories of abusive sexual contact that could implicate consent, I think that they're talking about substantial incapacitation. Of the three varieties of abusive sexual contact under the 2007 statute, there's more under the 2012 statute that we're not here to discuss. But I don't disagree with the holding in Prather that incapable of consent or incapacitation necessarily involves some amount of consent. But as Judge Weedy notes in the Barlow decision, Congress intended to write it out with respect to bodily harm, and they succeeded in doing so.
Well, wasn't Barlow involving fear, or am I remembering that incorrectly?
Judge, I don't believe so. It was the distinction between wrongful sexual contact and abusive sexual contact. And so a lot of these cases are not on all fours with this case, but they are discussing the elements test under Blockberger.
I'm sorry. Is it your position, then, if I understand you correctly, that consent is an issue only when the word consent or lack of consent, really, is in the statutory language, that Congress says, you know, whatever the offense is, and then uses the word consent to tell us that that's, in fact, an element?
As a matter of law, yes, Judge, but as this Court held in another unpublished decision just last month in the Wareham case, that the government could take on the element of consent in the charging specification. So there are certain categories of abusive sexual contact that will have consent as an element, and I believe that incapable of consent is one of those that, as a matter of law, has the element of consent there. But as the Wareham case set forth, and Judge C. Brown, in his opinion last month in the Wareham case, said that the specification in that case was salvaged by the fact that the government charged without consent at the end of the abuse of sexual contact specification.
Well, how do you reconcile the classic offense of assault consummated by a battery? I believe you put in your, I think it's in your assignment of errors brief, where you point to the fact that, in your view, the military judge got it wrong when she only listed two elements for assault consummated by a battery when she was discussing whether, in fact, it was an LAO in this case. And in particular, you point to the fact she mentions nothing of consent.
Yes, Judge.
And you point out that our Superior Court, CAF, has said, no, lack of consent is, in fact, an element, if we can use that term, of assault consummated by a battery. I guess my question is, While I believe this Court agrees with that lack of consent is in fact an element of assault consummated by a battery, if you know, looking at the text of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, the statute upon which that offense is premised, again, lack of consent is nowhere to be found in the statutory language. So my question to you is, number one, how did CAF come to the conclusion that lack of consent is, in fact, an element of assault consummated by a battery? And secondly, and related to that, how is that really any different than this situation when the statutory language makes no mention of lack of consent, but in fact uses the term bodily harm, which is found both in the statutory language of assault consummated by a battery as well as abusive sexual contact by causing bodily harm?
And those elements are the same, Judge, the bodily harm element. It's the other elements that differ. And CAF is interpreting the language, I believe it's otherwise unlawful conduct, in the Article 128 statute that is not present in the bodily harm. And that's where they're arriving at that consent language. And CAF has set forth very clearly that after Riggins, Article 128 has three elements. The charge in this case had two elements, and under Blockberger, this charge must be dismissed because it is not, in fact, a lesser-included offense of abusive sexual contact.
Counsel, let me just ask, when we talk about elements, who defines, or who can establish an element of a crime? Is that established by the President? Is that established by CAF? Or is that established by Congress?
Congress, Judge.
Okay. All right. So when we talk about the element of consent under assault consummated by a battery, you would agree that the statute assault that defines assault consummated by a battery does not include the word consent, correct?
The exact word consent, yes, I would agree with that, Judge, but CAF has interpreted it to necessarily include consent as an element.
All right, and that's actually what I was driving at. So really what we're talking about, when would you agree, when we say that consent is an element, is we're not saying that consent is separate or distinct from the elements of assault consummated by a battery, but that how those elements are defined necessarily incorporates the consent piece, or lack of consent.
No, Judge, I believe that the CAF is interpreting the actual language of the statute, otherwise unlawful in 128. So they're parsing out what used to be two elements, or excuse me, what used to be one element into two elements. So bodily harm, offense, and I'd have to look at the exact language of 128, Judge, but it's bodily harm and offensive touching that's not otherwise authorized, and it's that otherwise authorized by law that they are reading to mean a consent element.
Yeah, let me help you out here. The 2008 edition of the manual, which is the one that would be relevant here, although in this case this language has not changed till the present day, it talks in terms of two elements for assault consummated by a battery, the first element being that the accused did bodily harm to a certain person, and number two, that the bodily harm was done with unlawful force or violence. And so your position is where CAF comes to lack of consent is a requirement, if not an element, but, you know, using the term element a little loosely in this case, that lack of consent is necessarily a part of assault consummated by a battery, that your position is that comes from the unlawful force or violence, not necessarily from the definition of bodily harm?
That's correct, Judge, and I don't think that's just my position. I think that's CAF's position in Riggins. And this court, as you're well aware, is bound to adhere to our superior court's decisions.
And I've looked at Riggins, and I have not seen, and perhaps I missed it, CAF specifically saying that the element of consent was from the second element as opposed to the first element. Do you have any cases where they specifically tied it to just the second element of assault consummated by battery, which is the bodily harm is done with unlawful force or violence?
Judge, I'd invite this court's attention to page 83 of Riggins, which says the manual requires assault consummated by a battery be, quote, done with without legal justification or excuse, and then it goes into italics, and without lawful consent of the person affected. Now, they're referring to the manual there, but then they say, therefore, we previously held that lack of consent is an element of the offense assault consummated by a battery. So they're addressing the second element. And that's our position, Judge, is that this issue that we're discussing largely here this morning has been decided by the court in Riggins.
And let me ask, on the first element, we talked about bodily harm. Bodily harm is defined as an offensive touching, however slight.
Correct? Under the 2007 statute, yes, Judge. Okay.
Now, I'm actually talking in terms of the assault consummated by battery now, as opposed to the bodily, as opposed to the abuse of sexual contact. So I guess my question is this. is if an individual consents to a touching, is it there, can it be an offensive touching? In other words, by virtue of the individual consenting, saying it's okay, does that then lose its offensive nature so that it is no longer bodily harm?
Judge, I believe that the consent element is in the second element.
It may be there as well, but that's right. Why I want to focus you, because I think we can agree that bodily harm is effectively an element in both the greater offense you're talking about here as well as in the assault consummated by a battery, correct?
Yes, Judge, that's correct.
All right. So would you agree then that it would be critical in determining whether or not consent is an element of an abusive sexual contact by bodily harm to determine whether consent is necessarily included within the definition of bodily harm?
Perhaps under the 2012 version of Article 120, Judge. But here you don't need to go beyond Section 120R, which says consent is not an element of abusive sexual contact. And that's the end of the inquiry. The government may have a persuasive argument under the 2012 statute. And here I would say may, because the Navy Court in Gwin interprets the 2012 statute and says abusive sexual contact does not have the element of consent under the 2012 statute. But here this Court need not go interpreting elements or parsing elements when Congress has defined them quite clearly and said that abusive sexual contact does not have the element of consent.
Well, we don't even need to talk about the 2012 statute because it's, as we all agree, it doesn't apply here. And the alleged offense occurred in 2011. So, you know, and the fact that Congress went back and changed it, they did it for a variety of reasons, to include decisions of our superior court finding fault with the way aspects of the statutory language was constructed, to include criticisms about how consent was written and ultimately interpreted. But so, other than the fact to say, yes, they changed it, we got that. But beyond that, looking at what is or isn't present in the 2012 statute really is not relevant here. The question is what is present in the statute passed in 2000 or made effective in 2007 that is at issue here. Do you agree?
I agree with that, but if I can offer respectfully one quarrel, Chief Judge, which
sure.
is if you look at the definition of bodily harm in the 2007 statute and compare it to 2012, they change it. And my colleagues here in their brief, and they've admitted its error, they relied on the 2012 statute. But look at the 2012 statute. They specifically insert consent into the 2012 statute. And I think that means something, that they changed the definition of bodily harm from a offensive touching, however slight, to then in the 2012 version to mention that it includes any non-consensual contact. So I think that there is some importance.
And Kevin, that's an interesting argument, right? Because that turns on whether, since it turns on the meaning of including, correct? I mean, because if, is that adding additional information as to what would be considered to be bodily harm? Or by including, are they saying that that same definition we previously provided would have included this same stuff? And they're just clarifying themselves.
Right, and we're going to have to find out, Judge, as the years roll on, because the challenges to the 2012 statute are coming. But Chief Judge Drew, to your point, we're here discussing the 2007 statute, and the 2007
right.
statute says consent is not an element of abusive sexual contact. Under Riggins, under Blockberger, that ends, respectfully, this court's inquiry. And as the court said in Girard, the prejudice is clear. On page 11 of Girard, they say that the appellant was convicted, quote, appellant was convicted of an offense that was not an LIO of the charged offense, end quote. And that's exactly what we have here. We have Captain Bobby Honey, who's convicted of a charge that was never referred, never investigated, never served, and ultimately is not an LIO of the original crime, abuse of sexual contact.
And before you move to your next thing and talking in terms of prejudice, that argument I think is a little bit interesting because as I read Riggins, it seems as though CAF, in analyzing prejudice in that case, did a lot more than just say it was prejudice because it was a lesser included offense. They said, effectively, it might have been okay as long as he wasn't prejudiced. And again, it was a constitutional error beyond reasonable doubt. But the types of things that they've talked about is how the defense had defended based on this fear concept that the judge ended up finding the individual guilty on something that was not a rationale that was presented by the government or the defense. That seems to be different here. That seems to be, even if it wasn't an LIO, that the trial was based upon this lesser included offense of assault consummated of a battery. So why does that result in non-prejudicial error beyond reasonable doubt?
Two responses, Judge, and I think it's really laid out in Girard. I think that there are going to be a lot easier cases like Riggins with respect to notice. We don't concede that there was the legal concept of notice here under 601, 602, 603. This is a major change a month after arraignment, and if you're sitting as a trial judge, you wouldn't have allowed the government to trot in with a 128 offense at this point. And so we believe that there isn't sufficient notice as a legal concept, regardless of whether this can be distinguished from Riggins as a factual or in the colloquial sense of notice. But more importantly, Girard refers to two aspects of prejudice. They refer to a Fifth Amendment due process right not to be convicted of an offense that is not, in fact, an LIO, and then they refer to a Sixth Amendment right of notice, Judge. I think clearly we're here dealing with primarily the Fifth Amendment due process right not to be convicted of an offense. And I'm specifically referring to page 11 of Girard, where it says, and under the facts of this case, the prejudice is clear. Appellant was convicted of an offense that is not an LIO of the charged offense. Appellant did not agree to, and the military judge did not amend the charge or specification. And then they go on to discuss the Sixth Amendment notice that you're discussing. Judge, Captain Honey did have the ability, unlike some of these other cases where the LIO was announced at findings, to present a defense to this, the least serious of all of the charges that he's facing. We don't submit that satisfies the concept of legal notice, and more importantly, the due process concept that you can't be convicted of something that's not, in fact, a lesser-included offense. Now, had the judge inserted something else there, I don't think that the argument would be any different. I mean, had Judge Watkins issued the ruling saying, well, now the crime is dueling, the fact that Captain Honey was given 5 months advance notice that he was facing now a dueling charge, I think would be no different than the circumstances that you're dealing with here. Is the dueling is as much of a lesser included offense of abuse of sexual contact that Article 128 is, and that is, it's not at all.
How much advance notice do you think he was entitled to?
He's entitled to what is provided in the manual, Judge. So the five-day waiting period that's in, I believe it's 602, given that this is a major change in 603, it just simply can't happen after arraignment. And we're clearly a month after arraignment at the time that this happens.
It can't happen ever, or it can't happen over the objection of the defense?
You're absolutely right, Judge. And it cannot happen over the objection of the accused. And that's part of the problem here. It's frankly the part of the problem that was at issue in Girard, is that the Jones decision hadn't come out in Girard, and so no one would have known to make the Girard objection in Girard. And here, Riggins is 7-8 months in the future at the point of this, and the manual still lists Article 128 as a lesser offense of abuse of sexual contact. And so no one would have been any wiser, at Captain Honey's trial in May of 2015 that we're not actually dealing with a legitimate LIO here. Which is why this court ultimately has to view the plain error in light of the state of the appellate law at the time. That's set forth in Girard, and the combination of Girard and Riggins ultimately compels the result here. Yes, Judge.
So, first of all, I mean, we've asked a lot of questions, and I recognize that, so you haven't had a whole lot of time to actually talk about what you plan on talking about, so I have to say we're done asking questions. But don't worry about the time for the moment.
Thank you, Judge.
But I do want to hear, because it wasn't entirely clear from my reading of your briefs, what you believe the LIO of assault consummated by a battery, what was that at the time the first judge declared that it was an LIO? And then secondly, what was it that the second judge actually found Captain Honey guilty of? Were they the same? Were they different?
If they were different, how were they different?
Yes, Judge, and I'm referring to Appellate Exhibit 56 here, and it's paragraph 23. Now, mind you, the government was aware of the evidentiary problems that it faced in this case from jump. The investigating officer actually recommended that these charges not go forward, but that if the convening authority was going to send them forward, that they needed to amend the word vulva to pelvic region. That's in the investigating officer's recommendation. Judge Watkins references it in Appellate Exhibit 56. And the problem is that once they amend that and sexual contact is redefined as pelvic region, that fails to state an offense. And so the defense moved to dismiss those offenses. She agrees and dismisses those offenses, but she allows it to go forward, and she says, hence, with respect to Specification 2, she allows it to go forward, and she says, hence, in Specification 2, although the term pelvic region still exists, it's narrowed down to the touching of the vulva. The defense is placed on sufficient notice of the lesser-included offense. And so you have the Specification 2 is now allowed to go forward with the contact, and I don't know of any other way to say this, with the contact of penis touching the vulva, is what goes forward as the lesser-included offense. Now, the government has now cited another Appellate Exhibit 89, that has its genesis on page 805 of the record, and I frankly can't explain why that document exists. The second judge comes before the court. There's an 802 conference, apparently. They invoke RCM 910, which would have been proper if there had been some sort of plea negotiations at that point. And Captain Honey, Chief Judge, I see that my time has expired.
No, please go ahead.
It would have been proper for the parties then to agree to the language of a lesser included offense if there was going to be a plea at that time. But that obviously didn't happen in this case. And so I don't know that the draft specification that the government invites the court's attention to has any legal meaning whatsoever.
I tend to agree in terms of the inapplicability of the rule under these circumstances, because Captain Honey pled not guilty. He didn't plead guilty to a named lesser included offense, in which case it's then important to define what that is. But nevertheless, Appellate Exhibit 89 came into being, and you seem to indicate that it was the government that introduced it. My recollection of reading the record is, in fact, it was introduced by defense counsel.
And Judge, if I left you with that impression, that's incorrect. I believe that the judge instructs defense counsel to go and prepare that document, and the defense counsel complies with that. And it is submitted as Appellate Exhibit 89. I don't believe that it has any legal meaning, and I hope that this court is not about to adopt a proposition that the parties can agree at the close of the defense case on page 805 of a record of trial what the charge was that the trial just happened.
What we're looking at is the factual and legal sufficiency of the judge finding the accused guilty of assault consummated by battery, correct?
Yes, Judge.
All right, so as a precondition for us determining whether or not it's legally and factually sufficient, shouldn't we, as an initial matter, don't we have to determine what the trial judge actually found the accused guilty of?
Yes, Judge.
And is it not relevant that defense counsel put forth this specification and said, this is what we think we're defending against, and trial counsel said, yes, that's what we're prosecuting, and judge says, okay. It seems to me that's pretty strong evidence that when the judge came back with a guilty finding, he was finding him guilty of that specification. Let me ask you a slightly different way. What makes you think the judge's finding of guilty related to something other than the specification of the defense proposed?
Judge Watkins' ruling, Judge. Judge Watkins' ruling says it's limited to, it's narrowed down to the touching of the vulva, and the defense is on notice.
Okay, all right. So what has happened is that you would say that Judge Watkins said that the lesser-included offense of assault consummated by a battery, so you look at what the bodily harm was, and in the greater offense, it was the vulva language. but that at some point, because that's what was in the original specification under what constituted bodily harm, it had vulva, but that at some point at trial, defense counsel puts forth a draft specification of what they believe they're defending against, where it lists the bodily harm as the pelvic region. And then the judge says, okay, and then finds him guilty. You think that we should read that as the judge finding him guilty of something that apparently the defense, that the government wasn't prosecuting, the defense was not defending against?
I think that's a potential additional error. And Judge, mind you, this was raised 4 days ago. So there hasn't been briefing on the legal significance of this appellate exhibit. But he can only have been convicted of what the judge determined. And the only determination as to what the language of that specification is penis touching the vulva. That's the 128. And Judge, importantly, Judge Watkins dismissed everything that just said pelvic region. And so how we possibly go...
Well, actually, I believe dismissed, if I'm correct, dismissed the portion that said the pelvic region was the two-wit describing the sexual contact, correct?
Right, Judge.
She didn't talk in terms of dismissing the bodily harm, which remained vulva, correct?
Yes, Judge, but I think you have to look at it as a complete package. If you go back and look at the ruling, there's two specifications there, Specification 1 and 2. Specification 1, I believe, deals with incapacitation, as we've talked about. And it also is limited exclusively to pelvic regions. She dismisses that entirely because it fails to state an offense. The second specification says pelvic region with respect to sexual contact, but bodily harm, and I think I have that backwards. It's pelvic region with respect to, I'll have to take a look at it, Judge. It's pelvic region for one of the elements and bodily harm for the second element. And she allows it to go forward on the bodily harm element because it's penis touching vulva. It wouldn't have survived. And so I don't think that we're in the realm of where she is dismissing charges if they just reference pelvic region. Allowing it to go forward because it does have specificity, penis touching vulva, and then somehow at page 805 we're back to pelvic region, and that's the charge that Captain Honey stands convicted of.
All right, so I mean your time has expired.
Well, yes, Judge.
You reserve your 5 minutes, which remains intact, and you'll have an opportunity to take that, hopefully with less interference by the court. But as you sit down and think about it, the charged offense as modified and before Judge Watkins did have pelvic region was alleged to be the sexual contact, and vulva remained in that specification under what was alleged to be the bodily harm.
Yes, Judge.
For the second.
And actually, I would like for you on rebuttal to address this proposition, which is if the lesser-included offense changed from vulva to pelvic region, did that constitute a major, minor change, a major change, and if so, why? Why would it be a minor vice a major change?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Member Counsel, you may proceed.
May it please the Court, I am Major Jeremy Gaiman. Together with Mr. Roger Bruce, we represent the United States in this case. Assault consummated by a battery is a lesser-included offense of abusive sexual contact as charged in this case under a bodily harm theory, as both offenses as charged require proof of lack of consent. And Specification 2 of Charge 2 is legally and factually sufficient as the evidence proves that the appellant touched the victim's pelvic region with his penis. Your Honor, when talking about what is, regarding issue one, we're talking about what is a lesser-included offense. It's an elements test. You look to decide what the elements are, you decide what the meaning of those elements are, and then you compare the lesser offense with the greater offense to see if they're included. The principles of statutory construction apply, and you do not have, the words don't have to be identical when comparing those elements, and you look to the plain and ordinary meaning of those words in the statute. Now, the elements in abuse of sexual contact are that they're engaged in sexual contact, and in sexual contact is defined by statute as an intentional touching of specific body parts with a specific intent to abuse, humiliate, degrade or any person or arouse and gratify the sexual desires of any person by causing bodily harm, and bodily harm is defined as offensive touching of another, however slight.
But the word consent or lack of consent appears nowhere in either the statutory language or the definitions, which in this case actually I think are part of the statutory language, if I recall.
Yes, Your Honor. The definitions are part of statutory language, and you're correct, and the word consent does not appear. Which moves us, though, to assault and battery as well, as defined in the 2007 statute, is that assault and battery is that somebody did or consummated bodily harm, and then that bodily harm was done with unlawful force or violence. Again, though, you don't see consent, and this court was asking some questions of appellant about this, but you don't see consent in those elements as well. Where you do see consent, Your Honor, is you see consent in the definition provided by the President, which is not a part of the statutory language. However, our Superior Court has found that...
I'm sorry, not to interrupt.
Absolutely.
The definition for 128 or 120?
128, Your Honor.
Okay. Because unlike the 120 scenario where Congress actually provided the definition in the statute, for 128, assault consummated by battery being a subset of that, those definitions are in the manual, not in the UCMJ.
That's correct, Your Honor. Okay. It was the President that provided the definitions and wrote the word consent and when discussing assault consummated by a battery.
Counsel, so both the greater offense here as well as the assault consummated by a battery, they both have an element of bodily harm, is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And do you believe that term bodily harm is defined in the same way both for the greater offense and assault consummated by a battery?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. So I'm talking in terms of bodily harm, which is an offensive touching, however slight. In determining whether or not something is an offensive touching, do you believe that's a subjective test? Do you look to the individual that's being touched to whether or not they believe they're offended? Or do you believe it's an objective test where in determining whether or not something is offensive, we look to generally whether or not a reasonable person would have been offended by the touching?
Your Honor, I believe it's a subjective test. You look to the individual.
And I know I didn't specifically specify this issue or anything else. Do you happen to have any cases or anything else that would tease that out by any chance?
Yes, Your Honor, and I'll kind of walk through it on the assault consummated by a battery side of things in order to tease that out.
And as you're doing that, too, I'd be interested in you just specifically pointing out where in the President's definitions in the manual the word consent in 128 is specifically listed.
Where in the definitions, Your Honor?
Right. You indicated that the President specifically uses the word consent or lack of consent in the definition. And if you could just draw us directly to where that is.
Yes, Your Honor. I forget the specific citation under 128, what subparagraph it is, but it's when the President's providing definitions of an assault and how an assault should be accomplished. And it stated it should be accomplished without any legal justification or excuse and without consent to the victim.
And does that indicate that I guess what I'm particularly interested in, and while you look at it, is the position that the appellant has taken is the lack of consent element in 128 comes from the words unlawful force or violence, that's their position, as opposed to the common language between 128 and abusive sexual contact by causing bodily harm, that is, you know, does the element of lack of consent come from either solely or in addition the words bodily harm and the definition thereof?
Understood, Your Honor. And I would state, Your Honor, that consent does not come from the words unlawful force or violence. It comes from the bodily harm, the offensiveness of it. And I state that for two reasons. First, I'll start with the definition out of assault consummated by a battery given the President, and then I want to look to Johnson, which is the case that cited. Riggins cites the Bonner cites the Johnson. Johnson's where we get the element that consent is a part of assault consummated by a battery. So if you look at the definition under Article 128, it talks about what an assault is, and then it says bodily harm to another, whether or not the attempt is or offer is consummated, it must be done, the bodily harm must be done, without legal justification or excuse and without lawful consent of the person affected. The legal justification or excuse, that's talking about unlawful force or violence. Legal justification or excuse is unlawfulness. It separates out the idea of consent from unlawfulness. You can actually see this in the 2007 statute as well under wrongful sexual contact. There's a without legal justification or excuse and without the permission. So the two concepts are separated from each other. And then we go to Johnson, and in that discussion, Johnson was all about this this back rub that occurred in the workplace. And in that discussion of the victim's testimony in that case, Kaff talked about how she never testified that that contact was offensive. And they went through it. She never talked about it being offensive. She never testified it was offensive. She stated that it was maybe awkward because it was done in the workplace, but never said it was offensive. And then after all that discussion, they say, because of that testimony, we find that she did not consent.
And I'm sorry, counsel, what was that case?
That was United States v. Johnson, Your Honor.
Thank you.
It's cited in Riggins as well as Bonner. So the idea of consent is not tied to the unlawfulness. It's tied to the offensiveness. Indeed, Your Honor, Riggins left open the idea that assault consummated by a battery could be a lesser-included offense of bodily harm charge, depending on the circumstances. And the language in Riggins, they say this is, if accused is put on notice of being in fear of bodily harm, a person being touched in fear of bodily harm, and raises the issue of consent. So there's a notice of in fear of bodily harm and raises the issue of consent. That's exactly this case. In fact, this case is better because it's not in fear of bodily harm, it is actual bodily harm that's occurred in this case. And the case itself raises the issue of consent. And there's no way, if you look at abuse of sexual contact, and it has to be a touching of a specific body part, it has to be done with a specific intent to abuse, humiliate, degrade, or gratify. And that touching the body part with that specific intent has to be offensive to the victim. There's no way to prove that without proving lack of consent. How can it be offensive if they're consenting to the contact, in other words?
Can someone like offensive? Can someone like things that are offensive? In other words, can someone consent? I guess I'm teasing out a little bit more your argument that someone cannot consent to an offensive touching. Is that can I find the touching to be offensive, but yet still okay with me?
No, Your Honor. I think maybe you're blending words of what's offensive, like a contact that objectively maybe somebody would find offensive, as opposed to subjectively finding offensive. I guess maybe the best example is to give this, to go back to Johnson again. There was a back rub in the workplace, and she stated that, I don't forget the exact words of the victim, but she stated that maybe it was awkward or it was inappropriate because it was occurring in the workplace, but it didn't raise the level of being offensive. So just because something maybe is odd or outside of the norms of societal bounds, if they're stating that it's not offensive, that they were not personally offended by it, then they're consenting to it. So it's kind of like the idea of engaging in a boxing match. You know, if you're consenting to that contact, being punched in the face, most people would say would be offensive. But because you're agreeing to that being punched in the face, it's not offensive to you. You're consenting to that conduct. Specifically, though, going back to abuse of sexual contact, because it's touching a specific body part, and they have this intent to abuse, humiliate, degrade, or to arouse the sexual desires of any person, and that person, the victim, finds that contact with that intent to be offensive, there has to be a lack of consent. The government has to prove lack of consent in that scenario. Offensiveness is tied to consent. You see this a little bit in Bonner as well, where in the Kaff's discussion, they talk about how the permission element of wrongful sexual contact tied with the specific intent is offensive under the ordinary understanding of what offensive means. So they tie the idea of consent with the specific intent to being offensive, even in Bonner. And, Your Honor, even if this court decides not to decide, if you don't want to decide whether or not assault consummated by a battery is actually a lesser-included offense of abuse of sexual contact under a bodily harm theory, you can still look to waiver in this case because this was not an issue raised by the appellant at trial. Waiver does apply to situations involving lesser-included offenses. You can see this under Girard. Girard decided not to apply the waiver doctrine in that case under those specific facts, but those facts are an opposite to the facts in this case.
So I'm sorry. So you're saying that, let's assume for the moment, to use the appellant's example, that the first judge, Judge Watkins, had said, okay, the real offense here that she had determined to be a lesser-included offense was dueling. Clearly, objectively, not something that was raised in the greater offense. But nevertheless, judge rules dueling is the offense. If we were to look at that and say, well, as a matter of law, we don't believe dueling is a lesser-included offense of abusive sexual contact, are you saying that because the defense, after the judge ruled, didn't further object, that therefore they waived for purposes of dueling, it's now part of the charge sheet, and he could be, under those facts, found guilty of dueling?
Yes, Your Honor. And I would point the court to Wilkins. Under Wilkins, what happened is they charged the wrong, in the greater offense, they charged the wrong body part, and it was even wrong for the LIO, and the court, CAF, our Superior Court, found that it wasn't even a proper greater offense, and it wasn't even a proper lesser-included offense, that both were illegal impossibilities, but they still found the accused guilty of that lesser-included offense because they stated specifically that, we'll say this was a major or minor change, we don't even reach that because the accused never objected at trial to it. And by submitting that lesser-included offense to the finder of fact, that was an effective change on the charge sheet.
Well, okay, let me ask you the same question I asked Mr. Miser. At the time that Judge Watkins rules that assault consummated by a battery is a lesser-included offense of abusive sexual contact by offensive touching, what, in the government's view, was that lesser-included offense? In other words, what were the elements of that particular lesser-included offense?
Your Honor, I don't specifically remember the language used in the judge's ruling, but I believe that it was, as the appellant stated, that it had to do with the bodily harm, was the touching of the vulva, the penis touching of the vulva. I believe that's the language she used.
Yeah, and obviously that's what we're going through. I don't need you to necessarily off the top of your head recite the specific statutory language or the elements, but really the question is, at the time that Judge Watkins is ruling, the body part that's alleged to have been battered, if you will, in the government's view, as you're saying now, was vulva. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that's what she stated.
Okay. And so is it the government's position that when the accused was ultimately found guilty by the second judge, that the second judge found him guilty of battery upon the vulva?
No, Your Honor. He found him guilty using the language pelvic region.
Okay. And then how, in the government's view, did we get from vulva to pelvic region?
That change occurred when the judge asked the defense counsel in an 802 session to provide a draft specification, which defense counsel did. And then you look at the record at page 805, it talks about, and this, the judge specifically states, okay, so this is what the lesser-included offense looks like. Basically, this is what I'm going to be, when I go back and deliberate, this is what I'm using. And the government counsel and defense counsel both agreed.
Now, are you saying that the charges could be changed in an 802 session?
Potentially, yes, Your Honor. I mean, well, they were in this case when defense counsel submitted the appellate exhibit 89.
Well, so did they submit appellate exhibit 89 during an 802 session or during a 39A session?
During a 39A. They discussed it. I apologize, Your Honor. They discussed it in a 39A. The military judge brought up RCM 910 and asked counsel to take a look at that. Counsel, apparently during the break, did take a look at it and then submitted appellate exhibit 89 to the military judge. There was a discussion on the record then about how it came up and what was submitted to the military judge.
All right, so if I understand correctly, in the government's view, the lesser-included offense that Judge Watkins determined was present in the greater offense was battery upon vulva.
Yes, Your Honor.
But at the time, going forward several months later, the time of actual trial, and more importantly, at the time that the second military judge enters findings, that has changed from vulva to now pelvic region.
Yes, Your Honor.
As evidenced by Appellate Exhibit 89.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And then, so in the government's view, that change from vulva to pelvic region, is that a minor change? Is that a major change? Is that something else entirely? What's the government's position on that?
Well, in the last 16 minutes thinking about this, sir, I believe that it would be a major change because you're going from a more specific body place, the vulva, to a more general body place, the pelvic region.
Trial counsel, let me ask you this question. If an individual is charged with assault consummated by a battery and the offensive touching was that the individual punched the shoulder, and the evidence came out such that the individual was actually struck in the lower arm, do you believe that the members of the finder of fact could find the accused guilty of, by exception to substitutions, not the shoulder, but actually the lower arm?
And, Your Honor, that's a variance question.
And I'll say this before you answer. Variance is sort of the other side of a minor change, right? Because if a change constitutes a major change, then it would also presumably be an improper variance. And so that's why I threw it out there in terms of a variance sort of question, which you might have more experience with, perhaps.
Your Honor, I believe under that circumstance that would not be a major change as long as... I believe under that circumstance it would not be a major change, Your Honor, because the accused is still on notice of the incident that occurred and the general area where that assault and battery took place. In other words, the specific, the time, the date, and the incident where the contact occurred.
Do you believe pelvic region, or if an individual is, well, actually, I'll just put it this way. Suppose that the members see a specification, assault consummated by a battery, based on touching the vulva. And the members come back and they accept out vulva and they substitute in pelvic region. Do you believe that that would be an appropriate variance?
No, Your Honor. Because the specific body part under assault and battery is not as important as it would be under a abusive sexual contact, which has to be a specific body part.
And let me go back to an issue that you had talked about previously, which is the idea of waiver, specifically as it applies, waiver as compared to forfeiture. Did the defense counsel ever assert that they believed that a lesser-included offense of abusive sexual contact was assault consummated by a battery?
Did they ever assert it, Your Honor?
Yeah, I mean, in talking in terms of waiver, a relinquishment of a known right as opposed to a forfeiture, which is just not properly objecting or preserving, I'm trying to figure out where, under the facts of this case, if it would fit better within a forfeiture analysis or a waiver analysis.
And, Your Honor, there are four places on the record that the lesser included offense are discussed. They're on pages 256, 805, 835, and 840. Each of those times that the lesser included offense is discussed, the defense counsel agrees that that's the lesser included offense they're discussing, as well as does not object. Indeed, another time that it's talked about, the fifth time, is on page 393 when he specifically pleads not guilty to the lesser-included offense of assault consummated by a battery, specifically pleading to the lesser-included offense, using those words. And then again discussed on page 805, as we've talked about already when submitting Appellate Exhibit 89. And if you look at the record on page 256, 805, 835, and 840, it's very clear the military judge is stating, listen, is this the lesser-included offense that we're going forward on? And defense counsel each time, all four times, says, yes, it is.
Assuming that this court disagrees with the government and that we conclude that assault consummated by a battery is not a lesser-included offense, of abusive sexual contact by bodily harm. Do you have an argument as to why appellant would not be prejudiced by that, similar to a Riggins sort of analysis where Kat has determined whether or not he was prejudiced in that case?
Yes, Your Honor. So if you look at Riggins, you look at Wilkins, you can also look at Girard. There is a prejudice analysis. And the language out of Wilkins is actually informative. It states that just because there's error in a charge offense is not subject to automatic dismissal, even if it affects a constitutional right. Now, Riggins was affected a constitutional right because there was an objection, and so CAF did a prejudice analysis under a harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. But if you look at the language in Wilkins, Wilkins talks about the fact that if a constitutional issue is not raised, then it's your standard, it's not the heightened prejudice test, it's the lesser prejudice test of prejudice to a substantial material right of the accused. It's not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And the burden is actually on the appellant in this case. The appellant must show that under the totality of circumstances in this case, the government's error resulted in material prejudice to a substantial constitutional right to notice. And in Wilkins, they stated the appellant has not met this burden because he cannot establish prejudice to his ability to defend against the charge he was convicted of or his right to notice. So since the appellant can't show that his right to notice was violated, then it doesn't raise an issue, a constitutional issue, where you would have to do a prejudice analysis under a harmless beyond all reasonable doubt like you see in Riggins, which is why Riggins and Wilkins use different language and have different analysis.
Does the test you apply in this case, does it depend on whether or not the government wins or loses? In other words, if we apply a constitutional error test, does the government lose?
It doesn't. Under either burden, Your Honor, the government wins in this case.
Why?
Because the accused had notice. So his right not to be convicted of an uncharged offense, United States v. Jones has a line in there where an accused can be convicted of uncharged, lesser-included offenses specifically, precisely, is the language they use, because he has notice. And in this case, he had notice. The motions hearing was 5 months prior to trial. I'm sorry, the motions hearing was more than 5 months prior to trial, but the judge's ruling was 5 months prior to trial, and the trial in mid-December, and stated that the lesser-included offense would be going forward of assault consummated by a battery. The accused specifically pled not guilty to the lesser-included offense of assault and battery. And then it was talked on the record four times, and the accused never objected, never raised any issue. Additionally, they submitted a copy of what they believed the specification looked like to the military judge. And while it was in the middle of trial, it was before the government's rebuttal case. The defense didn't raise any objections, didn't state they weren't on notice, didn't state they had any problems, didn't state they would change their ability to put on a defense. And in fact, it did not change how they would put on their defense. There were several specifications that dealt with this particular victim. All of those specifications the accused had to defend against, and specifications 1 and 2 of charge 1 and this lesser-included offense we're discussing were charged in the alternative. You can see that on the record when they discuss unreasonable multiplication of charges. And so the defense theory had to be put forward to defend against all those three charges. And their theory was that this was a consensual hookup, if you look at the defense's closing argument, as well as their arguments they make in opening statement. So this did not change the way defense would put on their case with regard to this particular victim in any way, nor did they even raise it at trial.
Well, counsel, I'd like to bring you back to the position the government has taken, and that the change of the body part in this question, excuse me, in this case, constituted a major change as opposed to a minor change. If indeed it was a major change, why was that not a problem? How is it that the case could go forward on a major change without taking a break or otherwise doing anything else?
Your Honor, I point you to Wilkins. Wilkins specifically addressed that. Whether they even state that whether it was a major or minor change, we don't even get there because the defense never objected at trial. And regardless of the fact, the LIO was submitted, the lesser-included offense was submitted to the fact finder, and that was an effective change in the charge sheet. So regardless if it was a major or minor change, Your Honor, it doesn't make any difference because the defense never objected to it, and it was submitted to the trier of fact, and that is an effective change in the charge sheet. And, Your Honor, I see I have about 4 minutes left. May I move on to issue two?
You may.
This court is very familiar with the test required for legal and factual sufficiency. I won't spend any time on that. But the evidence shows beyond a reasonable doubt to this court that the accused penis did, in fact, touch either the pelvic area or the vulva. Government submits that it doesn't matter which one. This court decides that the evidence proves both. And you can look at really two witnesses to decide this, Your Honor. Look at the testimony from the victim as well as the testimony from Captain R.C. in the case, who talks about the appellant's admission about what happened. We also submitted to this court a supplemental side of the Williams decision, which discusses what exactly encompasses the vulva or the female genitalia, which includes the pubic mound. So if you look at the victim's testimony in this case, she talks about the pelvic bone. She talks about how his penis was touching her, where the body starts to curve, and references the pelvic bone. And it was the front that where the body starts to curve. So under the front is how she describes it in her testimony. This is clearly pointing to the pubic mound, which is a part of the vulva. So whether you're talking about pelvic region or vulva, her testimony provides facts beyond reasonable doubt that his penis did touch her there. If you're looking at pelvic region, obviously it's a little more expansive, so it's even easier to prove, Your Honor. In fact, the appellant admitted through testimony of Captain R.C. that he tried to have sex with the victim, and the only reason it didn't occur was because he was too big for her, or his penis was too large. And the appellant tries to argue now that this was kind of a bragging, that he was bragging, but if you look at the context of this conversation between the appellant and Captain R.C., Captain R.C. states that during this conversation, the appellant was expressing regret over the event. And twice during this testimony, Captain R.C. stated that the appellant was frustrated during this conversation. So this is not a conversation about bragging or the appellant's trying to brag about his sexual exploits. It's the exact opposite. He's frustrated with the victim. He's expressing regret over the incident. And he's telling Captain R.C., listen, we tried to have sex. He was very clear. Captain R.C. testified. It was very clear that they tried to have sex. He couldn't have sex because he was too big. So between the victim's testimony and Captain R.C.'s testimony, it is very clear that appellant's penis did, in fact, touch her vulva or pelvic region. Doesn't matter. If there are no further questions, may I briefly conclude?
Yes, you may.
Thank you. Assault consummated by a battery is a lesser-included offense of abusive sexual contact, as charged in this case in the theory of bodily harm. And Specification 2 of Charge 2 is legally and factually sufficient to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that appellant's penis did touch the victim's pelvic region or vulva in this case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Fellows, counsel.
Thank you, Judge. I began with reference to this court's decision in Barlow, Chief Judge, not because I believe that it's binding, but because I believe that it is so persuasive. It's on page 20 of the Lexis version of that opinion, where the court addresses really the argument that we're having here today, that without permission or consent cannot be necessarily included in the elements of abusive sexual contact, when Congress has unambiguously stated that consent is not at issue in abusive sexual contact cases, regardless of the common sense appeal of an argument to the contrary. While the scope of the meaning not at issue can be open to some interpretation, even the narrowest reading of the language requires a conclusion that without consent or permission is not an element of abusive sexual contact.
All right, and counsel, I pulled Barlow up, and unless I'm missing something, it does talk about abusive sexual contact, but it's by placing her in fear of reprisal by using his rank and military position. So isn't Barlow just effectively restating what Riggins held? In other words, those generalized comments you just talked about,
yes,
right,
sir,
now, couldn't we just as easily interpret those as referencing the theory of fear, which is what Riggins had looked at and said consent was not necessarily an element there?
Respectfully, no, Judge, because what Judge Weedy is talking about, and he cites it, is 120 Section R, which is the statute. Congress defines the elements. As we discussed earlier, Congress has said consent is not an element of abusive sexual contact, any abusive sexual contact under the 2007 version. Whether it's fear, bodily harm, or incapacitation, it's not an element according to Congress. That statute's been discarded, but that's what we're here today to address.
So the appellant's position is that in an abusive sexual contact scenario, any of the various theories, that if a alleged victim objectively and subjectively consents, it doesn't matter, it's still a prosecutable crime?
Under the 2007 statute, I believe that there is no other conclusion that you can draw. When Congress under 120R says that consent is not an element of those offenses, I think that you have to take that for what it means, Chief Judge. But while you may quarrel in the incapacitation, and I think that there's, that frankly, that that's a debatable proposition, abusive sexual contact doesn't list the consent. They don't list this unlawful element that 128, where Kevin Riggins has said the consent is derived. And then you have the statute in 120R saying consent is not at issue in these offenses. I don't think that you need to go further than just simply reading the plain language of the statute, Chief.
Well, I mean, the problem is unlike assault consummated by a battery, here Congress did, in fact, provide us the definitions, and to include the definition of bodily harm, which they define as the term bodily harm means any offensive touching of another, however slight. So your position is that if an alleged victim consents, it can nevertheless still be an offensive touching.
I believe under the 2007 version, yes, Judge. I think Congress was intentionally trying to strip consent. They were trying to make it easier to get sexual assault convictions, and I think Judge Weedy goes through that. Admittedly, he's discussing other aspects of 120, Judge Brown, but he goes through what Congress was trying to do. They were trying to remove it. You're well aware of the burden-shifting provision under rape that was declared unconstitutional.
Which also stands, does it not, for the proposition that despite Congress's efforts to completely remove consent based on how the elements were defined, to the extent Congress was trying to remove it, they didn't for certain offense, such as substantial incapacitation.
I believe that that's true, Judge, and that's why I think you could debate whether under substantial incapacitation consent is somehow necessarily included. I don't think it's open to debate under abuse of sexual contact, which is what we're here to discuss today. Judge, I would agree in response to your question before I paused that this is a major change, that the military judge could have, by exceptions and substitutions, found a narrower version to that what was charged. He could have gone smaller, I think, is how government counsel, I think, rightly submitted that issue to the court, but couldn't have enlarged it to pelvic region. And even if that could have happened, it was the judge's obligation to do that by findings by exceptions and substitutions, and that did not happen in this case.
So, just to be clear on the major versus minor, so if we actually had members here as opposed to a judge, and the elements that went back to the members was vulva, and the members accepted vulva and substituted pelvic region, do you think that would be a proper or appropriate variance, or do you think that would be something that was so far afield that it would not be an appropriate variance for the members to do?
Chief Judge Drew, I see that I'm out of time. If I may answer the judge's question and briefly conclude, I think it would have been an inappropriate variance. Had they gone from vulva to pelvic region, I don't believe that would have been a permissible finding. And, Judge, if I can just leave the court and having not even addressed the factual sufficiency issue, with page, it's actually 10 of Girard, and it's actually going to discuss the rights at stake or appellant's constitutional rights to notice and not to be convicted of a crime that is not an LIO. And then we get to what I think is on all fours with this case, which is appellant could not have waived either of these rights given at the time of appellant's court-martial, neither Miller nor Jones had been decided, The President had determined negligent homicide to be an LIO of murder and listed it as such in the MCM, and it had been recognized as an LIO by previous cases. And that's exactly what was the posture of this case before Riggins. Riggins has changed that, and we believe that Captain Honey is entitled to relief. I thank the Court very much for its time. Unless there are further questions, that concludes my argument.
Okay, one moment, please.
Counsel, I believe in the first part of your argument, you referred to footnote 7 in Riggins.
Yes, Your Honor.
And I think that government counsel referred to it without specifically mentioning the footnote number. But doesn't that footnote open up the idea that there can be an LIO assault consummated by a battery in this kind of case?
It certainly leaves open the possibility that 128 can be an LIO of other abusive sexual contact under the 2012 statute, Judge. It's certainly an open question. It didn't resolve this case definitively. But I think implicitly you're looking for the specifications or versions of 120 abusive sexual contact that have some element of consent. And incapacitation, I think, is clearly that. There are more under the 2012 version. For instance, obtaining sex by false pretenses, by pretending you're a doctor, I think that those probably all have some element of fraudulent inducement of consent. Abusive sexual contact does not, Judge.
Okay, thank you. Very well.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you for your arguments. We will render a decision in due course. Court is closed.
All right.